We are continuing our study of the great century in missions, that period in history between 1792 and 1914. It was a great century because in 1792, there was no reproducible pattern for Protestant missionary expansion. William Carey gave us that when he established the Baptist Missionary Society. Then, during succeeding years, a beachhead was established around the world. It's not so much that great masses of the world's people were won to Christ during the 19th century, but nearly everywhere, nearly in every nation, the church was established. A beachhead was established. And so today we want to look at the expansion of modern missions, the factors that contributed to that expansion, and then explore the extent of that expansion. What are some of the factors that contributed to the expansion of modern missions during the 19th century or the great century of missions? Well, the first factor is colonialism. What do we mean by colonialism? An easy to remember definition is this: the expansion of Western powers into Africa, Asia, and Latin America at the expense of the native people. Do you remember in the early centuries of Christianity that there existed the Pax Romana? That is, the Roman peace. That Rome was so strong that there were few rival competitors. And it was easy to travel everywhere because Roman military might simply made that possible. There are many ways in which the 19th century was similar. But it wasn't Pax Romana. It wasn't the Roman peace. It was Pax Britannica. It was the British peace. The British Navy ruled the seas, unchallenged. And the British Empire stretched around the world. Colonialism was in its heyday. Britain, of course, was not the only country which had a colonial empire. France had a colonial empire. Belgium had a colonial empire. Spain still had the remnants of a colonial empire. Germany had a colonial empire. And what this meant is because Africa and Asia and Latin America were to some extent under the control of these European nations, they provided an umbrella. They provided protection for missionaries who entered these areas. It made it safe for missionary work to be carried on. It's not that missionaries necessarily promoted colonialism or favored colonialism or enjoyed the benefits of colonialism without exposing the evils of colonialism, but colonialism was a fact of the time, and missionaries took advantage of it to spread the gospel. This was one of the factors that made the expansion of the church during the great century so significant. Another was the facility of travel. The steamship was invented. Up until that time, missionaries had to travel by sailing vessels. But with the advent of the steamship, trips that took months, sometimes half a year, were reduced to a matter of a few weeks, and in some cases, a matter of just a few days. This greatly facilitated the mobilization of missionaries, and it made their journeys much, not only much faster, but much safer as well. Add to this a third factor: spiritual revival. We have spoken about the awakenings that were occasioned by the Pietist movement in Germany, by the Moravians, by the awakening in England under John Wesley, and then in the United States, a time of revival during the 19th century, both in the earlier part of the century and then at mid-century and afterwards. There was great lay involvement in these revival movements, and they fueled emphasis upon evangelism and missions and propelled the missionary task of the church forward. From the ranks of those who came to a renewed relationship of Christ, from churches which rediscovered the Great Commission, there went forth many to serve in missionary service. And lastly, there was the decline of world religions. Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism. These great world religions were in a state of decay. No longer were they vital. No longer were they aggressive. And this made Christianity a very attractive alternative to many of the adherents of these other world religions, and opened the door for a hearing for the gospel of Christ. These were some of the factors then that contributed to the expansion of modern missions. What about the extent of this expansion? Let's examine various parts of the world. First, the Far East, China, Korea, Japan. China is a large, large nation. And during the 19th century, it was the largest of the non-Christian nations. Had the biggest population. And so naturally, it attracted a great deal of missionary endeavor. As we think about China, I want to focus upon Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor is perhaps the best-known missionary of the 19th century in Asia. And it's worth our time and attention to focus upon him because of the contribution that he made. He went to China at mid-century. And as he labored there, he came to some convictions that when he put into practice resulted in the establishment of the China Inland Mission. The China Inland Mission was the first of the modern faith missions, really not quite the first, but the first major faith mission, and it was to become a pattern for faith missions in the future. Up to that time, most of the missions were denominational in nature. But here was a mission that was interdenominational in nature. And there are five different characteristics of this mission which made it notable. First, it was to be interdenominational. It drew upon people of all denominations. As I just mentioned, most missions at that time were denominational in nature. But here was a mission that was open to people of all denominations to work together in the accomplishment of a task. Second, it was to be open to those of little formal education. He appealed to the working classes, and the response was great. Up to that time, most missionaries were very highly trained people, graduates of universities and theological seminaries. Third, his mission was identified with the Chinese people. He scandalized the British people who were living in China when he, who was a citizen of Great Britain, dressed in Chinese garb and wore a Chinese pigtail, and insisted that those missionaries who didn't have dark hair dye their hair in order that their pigtail be dark, as was the color of the hair of the Chinese people. So there was tremendous identification with the people, living at their level, living among the people, rather than living apart in missionary compounds and at a standard of living that was above that, of significantly above that of the Chinese people. Fourth, the mission which he established, the China Inland Mission, was to have widespread evangelism as a primary aim. Up to that time, most missionary activity had been concentrated in the great cities that were along the coast because they were easily accessible by steamship or previously by sailing vessel. And missionaries tended to cluster together for mutual support and mutual encouragement, and sometimes simply out of fear. And Hudson Taylor insisted that it was necessary for missionaries to occupy the whole of China. And he developed plans for the proclamation of the gospel to all the people in China. He thought of the nation as a whole. He thought of moving inland. He thought of occupying all of the provinces of China with missionaries. And at its height in the 1930s, the China Inland Mission was the largest mission in the whole world. It had over 1,300 missionaries. And they indeed were scattered all throughout China. In fact, when there was a reaction to Christian missionary work by very nationalist Chinese rulers and the Boxer Uprising, sometimes known as the Boxer Rebellion, took place, and there were 135 missionaries who were murdered and 53 of their children, 91 of those missionaries who were killed were from the China Inland Mission, and they were all in the same province. So there was a tremendous toll that took place then, but it was simply an indication that the China Inland Mission had widespread evangelism as its primary aim, and that their missionaries were vulnerable because they were scattered throughout the nation, and they were living among the Chinese people. And then lastly, the fifth characteristic of the China Inland Mission is that it was to be directed from China and not from England. Up to that time, most mission agencies were directed from their headquarters in the United States or in Europe. And so when a major decision had to be made, it meant that a letter had to travel from wherever the missionaries were back to headquarters, and maybe months later the answer would come back, often when the situation had changed so much that the answer no longer had a lot of validity. Well, Hudson Taylor insisted that the mission be directed from China, not from England. And so this mission is known as the granddaddy of all the faith missions. One of the characteristics of Hudson Taylor's approach to missions was that he did not ask for funds. He prayed to the Lord and did no solicitation, no fundraising whatsoever. The people depended on what the Lord provided. To tell us more about this key figure in mission history, we have a man who has a very special relationship to him. James Hudson Taylor III is the past general director of the Overseas Missionary Fellowship, formerly the China Inland Mission.
My great-grandfather, Hudson Taylor, was a product of the evangelical awakening. His forebears had been deeply influenced by John Wesley and the movement of God's Spirit in the 18th century, the latter part of the 18th century. He was also deeply influenced by a godly mother, and it was really through her prayers that he came to a personal experience of the Lord's saving grace in his life. And I think that that had a profound effect on his own understanding of God and the power of prayer, because he often said, "We can move men through God by prayer alone." And actually his conversion came about just in that way. His mother, miles away, gave a day to fasting and prayer for her son's conversion. And he, alone at home, wandered into his father's study, picked up a tract, and was so impressed by the words, "the finished work of Christ," that before too many minutes had passed, God began to speak, and he was praying. His mother, miles away, was also praying for him, and his conversion experience came about in that way. Subsequently, in his recruitment of missionaries, in his looking to God for the provision, financial needs of the missionaries and the growing force that went to China, he realized that God is faithful and that there is power in prayer. And his focus was not on a faith mission or his own faith. He always said, "I don't have a lot of faith, but God is faithful. And we need to really rely on God's faithfulness." The Lord prepared Hudson Taylor for his missionary service in China in a number of ways. First, in his home with godly parents and the spiritual nurture which he had there. Secondly, in secular experience in a bank. Beyond that, he also went on to study medicine because he realized that going to China just as a missionary in that day would not be acceptable. And he knew that it would be important for him to have a contribution to make to the people, to open their hearts and help them to see that there was nothing threatening about his presence or his motivation there. That preparation for medical work was also very good preparation for faith. And he learned lessons in a simple lifestyle, looking to the Lord for the provision for his financial needs. All of this was God's preparation for a young man going to China. Hudson Taylor arrived in China in 1854. The Taiping forces, the rebellion, they were attacking Shanghai just at the time he arrived, so it was a pretty exciting time. He was studying Mandarin there, and shells were bursting around the place where he was staying. But God protected him. Early on, he had an experience of working with William Burns, the famous Scottish evangelist. And I think Hudson Taylor early realized the importance of, one, language study, really good acquisition of the language. If you're to speak to the hearts of the people, you've got to know their heart language. Also, if you're to be accepted, you need to know how to live with them and identify with them in their lifestyle. So he lived among the people, not in a kind of missionary compound, a high, comfortable, affluent lifestyle, but very much as the common people did around him. It was not easy. Hot in the summer, cold in the winter. Putting on Chinese clothes in his effort to identify was also not easy. At first they were not comfortable, but even more uncomfortable was the animosity of the British community in Shanghai. His own people really ostracized him because they said, this is demeaning to the British people for you to be going around in Chinese dress. But Hudson Taylor hadn't come to China to bring the latest fashions from London. He had come to bring the gospel. And he realized that it was really important to so identify with the people that they would feel he isn't, superimposing on us his culture, but he has a message that is burning in his heart, and he's one with us. He dresses like we are, speaks like we do, and it was really, I think, going back to New Testament times and, in a sense, learning something personally of what it meant for Jesus to be incarnated. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us.
The impact of Hudson Taylor's life has been enormous. A very fine motion picture has been made of his life and is frequently shown in many, many places in Asia. I've been present at some of those showings, and the people would just weep. There's tremendous gratefulness among Chinese Christians throughout Asia and Chinese Christians in other parts of the world for the ministry of Hudson Taylor and what it has meant to their people. Let's move on now to other countries in the Far East. Korea. The first missionaries arrived in Korea, Presbyterians and Methodists, in 1882. Initially, there wasn't a great deal of response to the gospel. Probably the missionary who is best known in relationship to Korea is John Nevius. Nevius was really a missionary to China, and he developed a strategy for the expansion of the church called the Nevius Plan, which was adopted in Korea rather than in China. And that plan laid the foundation for what we call indigenous church growth. In other words, a church that was not dependent so much on outside resources, but was able to develop with the resources that God had placed within the church itself. We'll consider the Nevius Plan at a later time, but we need to recognize that it was John Nevius who laid the foundation for the enormous church growth which has taken place in Korea. In Japan, missionary work was different than in China and Korea, because in China and Korea, much of the early work was among the common people, Whereas in Japan, it was through schooling. And it was the upper classes and the upper middle classes which were first touched with the gospel. And Christianity made an impact during the 19th century in Japan far beyond its numbers. The church in Japan has always been very small, in part because it was so connected with schooling and with the intellectuals and with education. But it made an impact beyond the numerical percentage of its adherents. Moving into Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Indonesia, the Philippines were largely closed to Protestant missionary activity until after the Spanish-American War, when the Philippines ceased to be a colony of Spain. And after a slow beginning, great church growth began to take place among the Protestants in the Philippines. In Vietnam, in Laos, in Cambodia, the Christian and Missionary Alliance entered in 1911 and have been the predominant denomination in that part of Asia. In Indonesia, where the church has grown greatly in recent days, the foundation there was laid by missionaries from Holland, because Indonesia was for many years a colony of the Netherlands, and also by German pietists, particularly among the Batak people on Sumatra. A German missionary by the name of Nomensen is the best known of the 19th century missionaries to that part of the world. In the South Pacific, the islands of the Pacific were numerous, the people were primitive, cannibalism was practiced, and yet it was there that there was great response to the gospel. So that by the end of the 19th century, many times thousands of people who were former cannibals would come together around the Lord's table. And there was a missionary movement that grew up among the islands in Oceania or in the South Pacific that carried the gospel to other islands, using as a means of the transportation of missionaries' deep-sea canoes. That was the vehicle of missionary transportation in that part of the world. And the conversion to at least nominal Christianity involved almost everybody on many of these islands. In India, the gospel had slower going. In 1858, India came under Great Britain. It became a colony of Great Britain. Colonialism became a reality. And this created an umbrella for missionary work that accelerated the beginning that had taken place by the Danish Halle Mission, and then years later by Carey himself. In fact, in the half century between 1851 and 1901, the number of Christians in India increased tenfold. In the Middle East, perhaps because of the Crusades and a number of other factors, there was great resistance to the gospel. Most Protestant missionaries chose to work within the existing Greek Orthodox or Syrian Orthodox or Nestorian Orthodox churches, the ancient Christian churches which had become ghettos of traditional Christianity due to the fact that the forefathers of these churches had resisted Islam and had maintained a Christian church, but it was a Christian church that was very steeped in tradition and really more interested in preserving the culture of the people than in spreading the gospel. Early Protestant missionaries sought to renew these churches by the introduction of the Bible and through the teaching of the Bible. And sometimes they succeeded, but at other times the Protestant churches grew out of splits from these ancient churches when renewed people met with hostility when they tried to introduce additional renewal throughout the groups. Perhaps the best known 19th century missionary is a man by the name of Samuel Zwemer, who was a missionary in Arabia during the late 19th and early 20th century. Africa, of course, is known as a part of the world where David Livingston and Moffat ministered. Sierra Leone received missionaries in 1795. Liberia in 1833, there was a missionary movement there. And because of the fact that almost all of Africa, except for the country of Liberia, was under the colonial system, there was great missionary advance there during the 1900s. Latin America is the last part of the world we're going to consider as we look at the great century. Latin America was not recognized as a mission field for a long time. In fact, even as late as the Great Missionary Conference in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1910, there was the feeling that Latin America should not be considered a mission field. And the reason for that is because of the Roman Catholic presence there. Missionary leaders in Europe said, look, in Asia and in Africa, there's no form of Christianity whatsoever. Why should we be concerned about Latin America, which at least has some form of Christianity, when there are so many parts of the world that have no kind of Christianity? Let us send missionaries to Africa and to Asia and let the Roman Catholics have their way in Latin America. However, many North Americans saw that there was a very low level of Christian commitment in Latin America, and so there was missionary activity, not so much from Europe, but from the United States and from Canada, that was taking place in Latin America during the 19th century. At first, it was just a matter of distributing the Bible. In fact, the early heroes of Latin American Protestant missions were really Bible distributors. And the old axiom for missionary work in Latin America was first a Bible, then a convert, then a church. There was scripture distribution because the Roman Catholic Church tried to keep the Bible out of the hands of the laity. But there was advance in some countries. As early as 1882, the president of Guatemala invited Presbyterian missionaries to come to that country. And if you go to the capital city of Guatemala today, you'll see the National Palace. And right next door to the National Palace, you'll see the Central Presbyterian Church, because the president of the country gave that land to the Presbyterians, because he felt that Protestantism was the religion of progress, and that's what Latin America needed. It needed progress. We've surveyed the 19th century. We've seen that it indeed was a great century of missions, as beachheads were established all around the world, beachheads that would provide the basis for the further advance of the gospel in the 20th century.